Hello, and welcome to Mega City Book Club, a podcast all about the collected editions of the galaxy's greatest comic, 2000 AD. I'm Eamon Clark, and in this episode, my guest hails all the way from Buenos Aires. He got in touch with me through Twitter, where he's known as Judge Anon. Welcome to the Book Club, Anon.
Hello, how are you doing? How's everything going?
It's going very well over here, thank you. I'm very grateful for you doing this. So tell me, as I say, you're known as Judge Anon, but you can reveal your true identity to us.
Sure. My full name is Santiago Gabriel Mayor-Maisonneuve.
Right. Okay.
And, you know, I remember when I sent a script to Sargeus and they asked me for a name for a biography, for a small biography. And the first thing I said was, Santiago Gabriel Mayor-Maisonneuve is a big name, literally, writer from Argentina. Because I have that kind of sense of humor.
That's the bio. Yes, very good. Okay, so you've been published in Sargeus.
Yes, twice now, and a third time now in November, though I guess I should have saved that up for the upcoming projects part.
Yes, okay, well, we'll talk about that at the end, because that'll probably time with the release dates of this podcast. Okay, fascinating. So should I call you Anon or Santi or...?
Whichever is easier for you, man.
Okay. All right, so you know the first question here on Mega City Book Club is always about your 2000 AD origin story. And as ever, I'm fascinated with how the prog gets overseas and what sort of reception and what sort of coverage you get there. So tell me, how did you get into 2000 AD?
I actually had to go back and think real deep about this because I'd almost forgotten about a few details. But basically, it goes like this. It's the year 2004, 2005, and I've started reading Vertigo comics, you know, Sandman, Preacher, Transmetropolitan, all that stuff. And the thing about Vertigo comics... And the thing about reading Vertigo comics when you're a teenager is that you're usually coming from mainstream DC and Marvel stuff. So when you discover Vertigo, it's like you've been let in into this secret club, you know?
Yes.
This is real comics. Oh man, check out this awesome stuff. And you feel like you're the king of the world. You feel like you've stumbled upon something secret, something awesome. So, and the other thing about reading Vertigo is that if you're Googling, if you're searching the bibliography of any writer for Vertigo, sooner or later, usually sooner, you're going to stumble into 2000 AD. So, you know, oh, I love Preacher. What else has Garth Ennis written? I love Transmetropolitan. How did Warren Ellis get his start? I love Watchmen. I love V for Vendetta. Where did Alan Moore come from? And sooner or later, you run into 2000 AD. And sooner or later, you run into Dread. So I remember, and this is a very vivid thing that came to mind when I was trying to remember how I got into this. I remember going into the Wikipedia article for Just Dread and being mind blown. Because again, you're reading Vertigo, you think you know all there is to know about comics, you think everything is there. And suddenly finding out that there's this character who has been published since 1977 and you know nothing about him. How have I gone this far without never reading anything about this dude?
Right, so it opened up a whole new world of comics for you.
Absolutely. And you know, so I need to read more about this guy. And I got... Here's the thing, it's already hard enough finding regular mainstream comic books in English in Argentina. It's already hard enough, and you already had to pay cost an arm and a leg. We were just coming out of a huge economic crisis, et cetera, et cetera. But I managed to get my hands on the Titan Comics edition of Apocalypse War.
Ooh, yes, lovely.
The real old one, huge size. This is awesome. I need to know more. So I scoured up and down my entire city, like every single comic book shop, and found nothing. And eventually I had to resort to Let's say less than holy matters of acquiring Judge Dredd. I'm not going to go into detail.
Okay.
But anyway, so eventually I managed to get my hands on the case files. And that was the best 2 or 3 weeks of my life. Ooh. As I just plowed through them. That's the other thing about Dredd. You start one and... okay, what's the next one? What's the next one? What's the next one? And when you realize you've read like 2 or 3 books of those on one sitting. And then I got super into it to the point where I read the entire Judge Dredd magazine, all 3-4 volumes of it, before I even got into 2000 AD proper. And by then, I'd already managed to get a job, so I was able to start making orders overseas via Amazon, via the 2000 AD shop itself, via some dealers in the city who were able to bring stuff from the outside. So I started building a small collection, and also I started getting some random stuff that I just found in comic book shops. So my collection of Dredd is this Frankenstein monster of, like, the super old Titan Books collection of Anderson that has The Possessed and Four Dark Judges and nothing else.
Right.
A couple of Fleetway editions, Hall of Justice and Bad Science, that again, just a handful of colored editions of random storylines with following a theme. And that was, for the longest time, that was my collection. Just this shambling, pieced together monstrosity of random books. Until eventually I managed to, one job in particular, I managed to get, they had a program where you got points for working hard. You know, they give you that instead of giving you more money. And those points I traded in for Amazon credit. That was like $65 and such. And on that, I got me a box with 5 case files.
Lovely.
And, you know, I've never looked back after that. So I'm still working on it. I'm still getting some stuff, still getting some orders. I'm going to be ordering the Steve McManus biography soon. And that's about it. Oh, of course. Eventually, I managed to find out about the 2000 AD app, digital editions. And that's how I get the prog nowadays, although I still have to be kind of picky about it, because even in digital, even in without a physical edition, even without having to take into account import rates and such, it's still kind of a heavy investment.
Right. Okay. So you don't get the prog every
week? In print. Exactly. We don't get it on print. And usually what I do is I save money and I try to buy as much as I can at the end of the month or at the start of the month. But it really depends. You have to take into account that $1 is about 16 of our pesos.
Right.
It's not a good exchange rate at all, but it's worth it. It's usually worth it.
Okay, so there are some problems getting hold of it, but as you say, it's worth it. And in a way, you're getting all the collected editions. That's perfect for a podcast where we're talking about exactly that, 2000 AD in collections. So I guess that will bring us to the book we're talking about today. What have you chosen and why?
I have chosen the Judge Child Quest. And I chose it because for two reasons. One, because I think it's one of the major turning points for Dredd as a character, Dredd himself as a character. And two, because it introduces a host of different concepts, characters, and ideas that expand the world. They don't even expand the world, they expand the whole universe of Dredd itself, including the introduction of my absolute favorite secondary Dredd character, absolute favorite character that I absolutely love. Those more or less the reasons why I picked this.
Okay, splendid. The Judge Child Quest ran in progs 151 to 181, I think, or thereabouts, 1980, written by John Wagner. He writes the first 20 episodes by himself, and then the last six episodes see the start of his very productive writing partnership with Alan Grant. I should point out that it's all lettered by Tom Frame, who at this time was the regular, or had become the regular, Dredd letterer. And then we've got art by three great Judge Dredd artists, Brian Boland, Mick McMahon, and Ron Smith. I think it's the first time we've mentioned Ron Smith on this podcast, so we'll talk more about him in a little while. So tell us, just for anybody who's not read it recently or has never come across the Judge Child Quest, give us just a sort of brief outline of what the story's about.
The story is about Dredd looking for a child called Owen Chrysler, who has an eagle mark on his forehead. And he's looking for him because Judge Fay, the city's top precog, a side division had been introduced just a few months earlier in Judge Death. Judge Fay, in his deathbed, just as he was about to die, gave a prediction that the city would face a major disaster, a war unlike any other they had ever seen, that demons would spew out of the ground and kill all the citizens, and that this would happen in the year 2120. And the only way to stop it is to find the kid with the eagle mark on his forehead. And all he has is a name, Owen Chrysler. But he must be found because he's the only one who can lead the city out of this giant menace that's coming. So we already see what's interesting about Judge Child Quest, which is that it comes from a very fantasy sort of premise. There's a prophecy, there's a chosen one, there's a dying, almost kind of a wizard thing, and Dredd is sent out into the cursed earth because the files of Justice Department show that the only Owen Chrysler with a mark and having that kind of physical description, him and his family left for the cursed earth a while ago to work on one of the townships. So that's kind of something interesting, because Dredd so far has been a very sci-fi, very sort of ground... grounded, you know, it's a science fiction strip. So having such a fantasy premise for it, that really stood out while I was reading it.
Yes, it's an intriguing setup. And as you say, it will then send Dredd off on the quest, which at first takes him to the cursed earth and then far beyond that in later episodes. And as you say, this sort of, you know, this weird prediction from Judge Fay. And then along the way, a bit like when we discussed the Cursed Earth, it's a little bit episodic in a way, in that there's various places and strange characters that Dredd will encounter. And each one has its own separate sort of adventure. And there's some terrific stuff along the way in terms of the episodes. But yes, a weird psychic prediction that sends Dredd off on this mission.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting you mentioned the Cursed Earth, because in a lot of ways, the quest, Judge Child Quest, feels like a bit of a Cursed Earth 2. You know, there's a road movie feel to it. There are strange characters. There's a real effort to world build and to create new stuff and to touch upon some parts of story that you may not see, you may not have seen in other stories. Right off the bat, you know, you have Memphis as a slave market. You have the Brotherhood of Garbage, which is one of the first stops in Dredd's journey. A massive gang of people running an army of slaves, all on behalf of a mad garbage god called Pharaoh. That's where Ron Smith starts to shine, really. A guy, Pharaoh, who's said to have found giant vast mines of garbage and trash left over from the pre-nuclear war world. And all that stuff has become massively sought after in the post-war world. So he's become rich and crazy as a result, and started modeling himself after Egyptian gods or Egyptian pharaohs. Of course, because he's in Memphis. So he has found the Judge Child. He has bought it from a slave owner, and he wants him to be his spirit guide into the underworld once he dies, because Child has had a premonition that he's going to die. So he wants to kill himself along with the Judge Child so he can work as a guide into the underworld. And that's just the first three or four episodes.
Yes, it does get off and running very quickly. In fact, the very first episode, Dredd's already out in the cursed earth, and then we get sort of flashbacks that tell us about Judge Fay's deathbed prediction and so on. Yeah, tremendous stuff. I mean, you mentioned, you know, that it's a sort of another version of the cursed earth, but of course the big difference is most of the cursed earth written by Pat Mills, and now we get John Wagner, the creator of Dredd, sort of taking over. And I know from various, you know, like from Thrill Power Overload and so on, that one of the main distinctions they made was that Pat Mills thought Dredd was quite a heroic character. So in The Cursed Earth, we often see him getting sidetracked from his mission to help out the various townships and people he encounters. But Wagner always had this slightly more that Dredd was an anti-hero, that Dredd had, you know, nasty elements to his character. And so in this one, we get a much more dogged and determined Dredd, who, you know, does say, I think very early on, I will not be sidetracked from my mission. I will get to it, you know.
And I think it's also interesting to see the difference in how Wagner and Mills both develop the character. Mills usually goes for more of an extensive sort of development, where you constantly see Dredd either getting sidetracked to protect others or to help others, or where you get these long stories where the point is constantly driven on. Meanwhile, Wagner's development of the character is more more like single massive instances and massive decisions that Dredd makes, but that happen in a very short span of time, comparatively so with Mills. So while Mills' development is more spread out over the strip, Wagner is more of a more like a bullet kind of development. It's like one shot, bam, this is what Dredd is. And it's very shown up all in a few pivotal moments across the Judge Child quest, most importantly at the very end. So the result of that to me is that quest feels a little more, what would I say, slightly more unfocused than The Cursed Earth on terms of development and in terms of plot, because Cursed Earth has a very strict, very linear goal and very linear trip. Meanwhile, Judge Child quest is, well, now we're here, and we need to find this so we can go here, so we can find this other thing, so we can eventually find the target. So it's a bit more unfocused in terms of the trip itself, but it pays off to me in terms of character development in general and in terms of universe building.
Yes, and, you know, as you say, in terms of expanding the universe of Dredd, I mean, he'd previously been on the moon for that brief period where he was Marshal of Luna 1, but this is the first time I think we really see him going off-world, and we get some crazy space adventures, which we'll talk about a little bit as we go along. But of course, he also gets his crew that come with him. It will introduce Barbara Hershey. This is her first appearance. We get the poor Judge Lopez, who's not going to do terribly well. The pilot, Lata. So he gets a crew to come with him, although he notably, again, showing Dredd's character, he chucks the accountant out straight away.
Here's what I love about that particular spread, okay? So the first few episodes are Memphis and Texas City, that gorgeous Mick McMahon spread. And, you know, so far it's been a regular road trip on Earth. And you get to Texas City, and then the Angel Gang kidnap the Judge Child and escape out into space. And here's the thing. You're not really sure where the Angel Gang have escaped to. And I'm not a prog wanner. I'm not the kind of people who read this while it was ongoing, sadly. But I can imagine how it must have been to see, you know, Prog ends with Dredd going, I'm going to chase him no matter where it takes me. Okay, so he's probably going to go back into the cursed earth. We're probably going to get, you know, maybe one trip. Week passes, and the first thing you see is this huge spaceship flying out of space, flying out away from Earth, and Dredd going, okay, we're going to go to space now.
Absolutely, yes. As you say.
What? No, I guess we're doing this now. And that's one of the things I love about early 2080 and 2080 in general, which is that kind of madcap, you know, this space, we're on Earth, now we're in space, deal with it, get yes. along for the ride.
A Brian Bolland double page splash, and there is just this one, as you say, this huge spaceship flying straight towards us out of the page with the crew just visible below the Justice Eagle on the top. Yeah, great stuff.
I also love one thing, one small detail, right? So Justice One is said to... Dredd doesn't go back to Mega City One. Justice One comes to him. They find him at the Texas spaceport. And the accountant, I think his name is Winslow, something like that.
Yep.
Dredd chucks him out of the ship. And they don't stop at Mega City One. So he chucked this accountant guy in Texas City and told him to take a hike back to Mega City One.
Yes. Poor chap.
Dredd, I mean, I know you're in a hurry here, but that's kind of...
It's tough stuff. So we get these wonderful characters in his supporting cast, but you've already mentioned, you know, possibly the most famous supporting characters from the Judge Child Quest, which of course is the Angel Gang, introduced by Mick McMahon on the cover of Prog 160, that famous cover showing them the Angel Gang. So as you say, this is before they leave the Cursed Earth, the sort of Tech City adventure. They'll have the Judge Child for the rest of the quest, and Dredd is in pursuit of them. Although it's probably not till later in the book that we find out quite how vicious and nasty the Angel Gang are. But John Wagner creating these very memorable characters, fascinating stuff right there, I think just after the first five episodes or thereabouts.
Also known as John Wagner loves to ride rednecks.
Yes, very good. The Redneck Angel Gang.
It's interesting because, you know, Wagner has mentioned before how characters like Judge Death or so tend to grind the dialogue to a halt because of their speech patterns and such. And the Angel Gang, they are really worthy guys. They talk a lot. Like, you know, take a note or something and try to write how many words are in a regular Angel Gang panel, save for maybe Mean Machine, and then compare them to how many words you see in a Dredd word balloon. And it's like, these guys talk a lot, especially when they're together. So you can see that Wagner had a lot of fun writing the guys.
And, you know, there they are now out in space following them. And we start with Brian Bolland and a wonderful, where they encounter a sort of rogue space station.
Echo Bravo.
Yes, Echo Bravo 4. We get wonderful little notes from Dredd's log along the way, which is where a lot of his sort of character and the fact that he's, as you say, he's got these strange and very determined character traits which come out in the log. And then we get a lovely interlude with a Mick McMahon story about Buggo the Brave.
Oh, every time I see these stories, I always get a little smile inside because it was such a thing of the time, you know, chariots of the gods, ancient aliens, ancient astronauts. You see it all the time in late 70s, early 80s comics. And this one in particular I love because, one, it has Mick McMahon on art, and two, I adore reading Wagner writing in rhyme.
Yes.
It's so good. So good. And also it's funny to see a Dredd story where he only appears in one panel at the very end.
Where he just gets to say most odd behavior. And then just as one flies off, they're on their way to the next planet to explore. It's a remarkable interlude. You know, as you say, maybe just so John Wagner could indulge his tendency to rhyme and also give Mick McMahon something wonderful to draw.
Here's the thing about drawing, too. I wanted to talk about going back to the early episodes. What's shocking about Ron Smith's art, for instance, is how dense it is. The amount of characters in the page are absolutely insane. You look at something like the Memphis slave market, or you look at the procession of King Pharaoh, and then you compare that with things like Mick McMahon's Texas City or the caves in this episode, and it's so interesting to see how Ron Smith usually focuses on characters. Like, he focuses on giving each one their own unique identity. But McMahon seems to have more of a worry on the background itself, on architecture and caves, rocks, trees, everything. So you can see how each episode seems to be playing to their artist's strengths, or maybe the artists were, you know, flexing what they each tried to draw. So that's kind of something that I value a lot about Judge Dredd in general, how you see all these different artists with all their different styles, and each one gets their chance to shine in their own particular way.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is the Judge Child Quest is a brilliant showcase for these three artists. We have that marvelous, as you say, Buggo the Brave's Chariots of the Gods episode. We've already talked about Brian Bolland's wonderful spaceships and Echo Bravo 4. And then the next one, we're back with Ron Smith again as they land on the planet of the Body Brokers. Again, wonderful characters. And Ron Smith, I mean, as I say, it's the first time we've encountered him on this podcast. For me, one of the great early Judge Dredd artists. I was reading Michael Mulcher's creator interviews, which you can buy on the Kindle. They first appeared, I think, as interviews in the Judge Dredd magazine, but they're collected together. And I was reading his interview with Ron Smith in preparation for this podcast, and also Alan Grant's recollections of working with Ron Smith in Thrill Power Overload. Because famously, he was the alarm clock artist, the artist who worked out exactly how long he had to produce, you know, each page in order to make a profit. And he would set the alarm clock, do the page. When the alarm bell rang, that was it. The page was finished and on to the next one. And yet the detail in these Judge Child Quest pages, the stuff that's going on in the background, it's remarkable how much he manages to squeeze into a page.
God, yes. And here's the thing about Ron Smith. I think that he's underrated in general, mostly because he isn't immediately stylized, or he doesn't seem to have that kind of immediate style or impact that Ball and McMahon have. And a part of that to me is that Ron Smith's greatest strengths demand that you stop and look. For instance, his panel density and the amount of stuff going on in each panel. You need to stop and you need to really look at the panel and look at each individual person. You need to see their traits, their facial expressions. You need to stop and you need to watch and really observe what's going on in the panel. And secondly, his expressions. Like, nobody does over dramatic, huge shouting faces like Ron Smith. So it's kind of a shock when you're reading a story about a supposedly, you know, faceless, very stoic kind of character. But I've even seen some people say, you know, I don't like Ron Smith's art, he looks kind of ugly. But when you stop and you really look at it in general, I mean, you take a closer look at it, everything starts clicking together and you start seeing how good he is. And then you get to the action scenes, and the action scenes are phenomenal stuff.
Yes, he directs a page brilliantly in his panel layout, in the action. I'm looking at him getting involved with the flying aliens on the planet of the Body Brokers. His dread is very lithe and athletic. He's, you know, dread leaps around a lot.
Rolls,
yeah,
jumps.
Rolls, jumps. He's got the two guns. He's got the two lawgivers, which is a Ron Smith touch.
Yeah, that's totally something that only Ron Smith seems to do, which is, you know, dread as this guns blazing cowboy shooting two guns at the same time while standing all bow-legged. That's really a very Ron Smith thing to do.
And you also, you mentioned, you know, his dramatic facial expressions. And as you say, he loves to show dread perhaps slightly from underneath, an angle coming up on dread and his helmet. And his mouth is usually, I'm looking at these panels now, is usually open as if he's shouting and, you know, full on dread anger. It's great. I love it. I love Ron Smith art and this, you know, his work here on the Judge Child Quest. Just fabulous stuff.
Yeah, absolutely great. Especially his action, the way he, you know, he'll have someone shooting or getting shot and you'll see them on the corner of the panel all twisted up in this super forced perspective kind of deal. It almost feels like something three-dimensional. Like,
yes, it leaps off the page. And as you say, particularly his action sequences are just fabulous. They're so dramatic. There's so much action and movement. As you say, Dredd's always rolling or jumping or leaping, and various aliens around him. Then there's, of course, the episode where they get involved in the planetary war, this big war game. Dredd and Hershey on their Loremasters riding into battle. It's absolutely astounding stuff to look at.
Yeah, definitely. So the part of the war, the parts 12 and 13, those may be, spoiler alert, may be my favorite part of the Judge Child Quest in general. First, because it's such a Wagner concept of, he already used that, a war as a sport, used to solve disputes between two different groups already in the Luna One stories with, you know, this is the war. But here's like, let's take that to another level. Let's have this huge, massive, planet-wide contest, and let's give them rules, let's give them a halftime, let's give them, you know, different kinds of weapons. Let's basically try to kill Ron Smith by making him draw all these crazy stuff going on.
How much can we give Ron Smith to do? And yet he still manages to produce it. Crazy rolling war machines, robotic knights, the works. It's terrific.
And, you know, Wagner gets to indulge his riding sports commentator. You know, he loves that stuff. And here he gets four or five of them, different ones. He gets to write a whole panel of sports commentators talking about war and giving the, well, you know, these aliens, they're real crackers. I noticed their speed. They get off two shots while our lads are still thinking about the first. I love that line so much.
Yeah, it's terrific, isn't it? Yes. I've just done the Chopper Song of the Surfer, which came out today, and that's another one where John Wagner indulged his fondness for sports commentary. But here it was, as you say, he did it first in the Luna One stories, and then here in the parts 12 and 13 of The Judge Child.
Yeah, also, I wanted to mention something because I was giving the book a once-over to get stuff to talk about. And on the one of the early panels, one of the early pages in this story, when the Gallipardians are charging the Lurgan front on these giant robo steeds, if you look at the panel itself of the battle, which is this whole like L panel here, look at all the detail, all the stuff that's going on. Like, there's one guy getting impaled by the unicorn horn of one of these robo horses, and he's in midair getting impaled with little spots of blood. I've read this story like four or five times before. I'd never noticed that.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the amount of detail he's put in this panel that runs along the bottom of the page and up the right-hand side, as the aliens attack, and there's flying sort of ships, which I presume are the cameras and the sportscasters and the referees and the umpires hovering above them. And in the distance, the flag on the hill, which is their sort of target. The detail and the way it works in black and white is just astounding to look at. And again, from an artist who was working against the clock to be able to produce this amount of stuff. And John Wagner, you know, writing, here's a huge alien war game on a planet.
Yeah, I imagine that the panel description for that must have been, you know, panel 5, Galliparians are charging the Lurgan's hill, period.
Yeah. They've been forced into a tight defensive ring around their home mound and they're dying in droves, says the sportscaster. And that's what Ron Smith gives us.
It's just great stuff. And then we get the rest of the story. Here's something that I'd really like to know. You know how when Dredd and Hershey enter the battlefield, they're talking in tongues? You know,
yes.
Just random gibberish, and that's then used as a translator. I'm actually wondering, is it possible to actually read what they might be saying? Because there's one panel where Hershey screams Dredd and calls by name, and you can tell that it says Dredd. But the rest is absolute gibberish. And I'm wondering if actually Wagner wrote that somewhere. Like, it can't be anything too important, but just kind of curiosity.
Yes, it'd be fascinating to know if that was created by Tom Frame, you know, what the instructions were from John Wagner. If you are listening to this podcast and you've deciphered Hershey and Dredd's alien tongue, then do let us know. It's fascinating. I suspect it's Tom Frame just indulging himself with instructions from Wagner to just give them something alien and weird to say.
And then we get the war wheels. The war wheels. Here's the thing, okay? Back in the 50s, something like that, DC published a comic called Black Hawk. Black Hawk. You know, a collection of different pilots from different countries that banded together as this kind of freelance peacekeeping force. And one of their major enemies was the Nazi war wheel, which they have fought in World War II. So seeing a different war wheel, of course, this one, the one in Judge Chalquist, makes a war wheel from Black Hawk look like a baby, like a 2-year toddler. And so I love the concept of a war wheel as this brutal example of war in its purest form. Like, here's this massive killing machine that just rolls forward, butchers the living hell out of anything standing in its path. And here, which is, you get this giant massive roller that has these lids that open so guns can fire out of it as it moves forward. And it's amazing because the second you see it, you can tell how it works, like, yes, immediately. Oh, it has guns, and as it moves forward, the lids for the guns close and new ones open. Okay, that's brutal. Awesome, but brutal. And it's such a massive, great scene on the... It's so good that it actually appears again in the next episode. Like, oh, I need to draw this again. I need to draw it bigger and badder.
And Ron Smith lays it out across again, another double page splash at the start of part 14. Nothing can stand against the war wheels. Yeah, again, Wagner's instruction, and Ron Smith delivers it and directs it as well. It's brilliant.
And then we get this beautiful, beautiful action scene with the Lawmasters, which, honestly, the only thing I don't like about this scene is that it goes on too quickly. It's just 2 pages and it feels like 4 or 5.
Yes.
Hell, it's not even 2 pages. It's like 1 page because half of each page is taken by the commentators. So you get this mad dash between the two Lawmasters and they're throwing the flag at each other and such. And it's a great scene. I only wish it just lasts like a whole nother episode. I could read 10 pages of that.
Yeah, lovely. And Ron Smith, of course, gives us some wonderful creepy aliens back in the studio talking about the action, as you've said. So, it's a great episode, but of course, Dredd and crew have to move on, and we get the artist changes again. We get the Murd the Oppressor episodes with Mick McMahon back on art. But also, when we talk about artists and their episodes, we have to talk a little bit about the Jigsaw Man and Brian Bolland.
Here's the thing, okay? I was talking before about how each episode seems to play to different artists' strength. McMahon draws this beautiful kind of horror, ominous, pitch black. You can even see it already on each page he draws. You see that he pours on the blacks and the heavy shading and stuff. He's not so good at action. He's good, but he's not as good as Smith. So you can see him draw everything about Murd the Oppressor, and before that, The Hungry Planet.
Yes, oh, that's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, everything that needs to do this kind of super dark, horror, creepy, terrifying stuff, McMahon does it and does it beautifully. And what's particularly beautiful about the Murd the Oppressor parts 15 and 16 is that it harkens back to the kind of fantasy storytelling that we talked about in the past. And then, you know, here's a prophecy about a chosen one. Here's a necromancer, a giant, massive, horrible beast that uses voodoo dolls and creatures that he calls forth inside a castle to sacrifice people to a giant toad. And it's like Dredd has just stepped into someone's D&D campaign.
Yes, it would make a very good campaign. Yeah, very good monsters. And as you say, loads of blacks on the page, lots of dark areas. As you say, it's become a horror film. It's become, as you say, either D&D or a Hammer horror with these dreadful creatures and the necromancer who seems to be controlling everything.
That beautiful panel of when Dredd tells him, you know, give me some and let me go and you'll save yourself a lot of trouble. And Murd starts laughing in his face and he looks terrifying. He looks like a giant monster. Just
yes, so it's a wonderful creepy panel. Just Murd the Oppressor laughing at Dredd. And the next thing, of course, is that Dredd is to be sacrificed to this giant toad, Sagbelly. And then there's vampire bats, there's those weird watcher creatures. It is some weird and wonderful dungeon that Dredd has found himself in as he, you know, his quest continues for this time for the Oracle Spice, which will give him clues to the location of the Judge Child.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was talking about before, about how sometimes it feels unfocused, because they're literally going to look for a MacGuffin to get the other MacGuffin. They go like, we need the spice to find the Judge Child. So that's one objective that leads to the other. And it's a different change of pace from, we need to get here. We need to go here and there's all this stuff between us and there. So it feels a bit unfocused at times, but it helps because you get these creepy horror vibe thing. So the individual episodes make up, in my mind, for the general sense of meandering of the story in general.
And of course, I've mentioned him already. It meanders on next to another planet, the weird and wonderful planet Ab. And again, something episodic, something apparently created by Wagner specifically for Brian Bolland. The weird aliens, their weird teacup world, and then this poor chap who's suffering from jigsaw disease. And I'm sure everybody's familiar with some of these great Bolland episodes or images from this one.
Well, what I love about the jigsaw disease is that it's this very 2000 AD mix of absolutely horrifying, but cartoonishly comedic. Like, how is this guy walking around with a square bit of tummy just out, just disappeared from his body?
Yes. How is he holding that? How is he holding that pot of pills when there doesn't seem to be any connection between his palm and his fingertips?
And it's goofy and it's kind of ridiculous, but at the same time, it's so horrifying. And Bolland sells it almost entirely on facial expression. Like, you see his face and he's horrified. He cannot imagine what's going on. He can't even begin to understand it. All he knows is that he's dying, and he's dying very quickly. And that's what keeps it from going the full, like, farcical, haha, look at this guy. It's a terrifying vision.
Yes, the dark humour that John Wagner is famous for in 2000 AD, and as you say, here is a perfect example of it. This poor chap Prosser slowly fading away, but who may know something about the whereabouts of the Angel Gang and the Judge Child. So Dredd has to track him down before he completely vanishes.
And before that, we get, you know, Bolan also putting in a little bit of horror with poor Judge Lopez taking the Oracle spice.
Yes, now I'm looking at the cover of Prog 172, which is that looks like Carlos Esquerra, actually, as Judge Lopez strapped to the bed. And then the stretched faces of Dredd and Hershey, which I believe that Bolland managed with some form of overhead projector to sort of like throw a stretched image onto the wall that he could draw from. It's not included as one of the covers in the Titan collection that I'm looking at, but it's a terrific cover. And yes, poor old Judge Lopez, given the Oracle spice because he's most sensitive to it. And he has these weird and terrifying visions, speaks in riddles, but gives them a clue as to what's going on or where to go next.
I love that Dredd has he adheres to the Batman style of investigation, which is let the computer do it. So, you know, you get into this part where he goes to Bedlam, and something that I love about Bedlam is that the only explanation for how weird the planet is, it's an alien world. Things are weird. I bet if I went to Earth, it would be weird for me too. And that's such a great, you know, take it or leave it idea of, well, you either accept this or, nah, I don't care. They just don't care about giving an explanation as to why is this building like this? Why is this people like that? It's a weird planet. It happens.
Yes, lots of weird aliens in the background doing all sorts of peculiar stuff, including one of them appearing to be reading an upside-down copy of 2000 AD while he sits on the shoulders of another alien who's walking a tightrope. You know, the sort of stuff that only Brian Bolland could probably give us.
And I love that it's a small detail, but I love that even all the aliens, except the one reading 2000 AD on that page, they're all looking at Dredd. To them, Dredd is the weird one.
Yes.
He's the out-of-place guy. He's like, oh, who's this guy running around in some kind of weird motorcycle thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing.
Yeah, you know, everything happens. Lopez finally. And then we get the moment, one of the most important moments in the Judge Child quest, which is Prosser's explanation of what happened with the Judge Child. For anyone who hasn't read it, Prosser was a pilot in one of the ships that the Angel Gang commandeered, and he asks the Judge Child if he's going to get any money for this job, and the child just laughs at him. Chrysler laughs and says that he won't take any of that money because he's going to be taken by disease. So the Angel Gang say, if it's a disease, we could all catch it, and they toss Prosser out into Bedlam, which is where he gets the disease. So he explains that to Dredd, and he says in a beautiful, beautiful scene. I absolutely adore this scene where only his lips remain, not even his mouth, just his lips and teeth. And even as just a pair of lips, he can still see the anger when he tells Dredd about it. He says he caught the disease here. If the kid hadn't told them, they'd never have set me adrift and I'd still be alive. The boy killed me as surely as if he stuck a knife in my heart. He sent me to my death and he laughed about it. Your precious Judge Child is evil. And you can see just how angry, how furious he is at it. And that in a way is a prophecy on itself. I mean, he's giving this kind of advice to Dredd. And it's a beautiful moment and one of the most important moments in the quest for me. It explicitly sets everything up for the ending.
Yes, and of course, Bolan, as you say, delivers that anger, that rage and frustration at the dying of the light. But he does it all with just a pair of lips and some teeth, and that's it, which is all that's left of Prosser at this stage before he pops out of existence. But as you say, we've had the development of Dredd's character. He's dogged, he's determined, he's not very keen on Lopez's facial hair and so on. But we've had these clues to Owen Chrysler as we've gone along, the development of his character as the quest progresses, and we learn more and more about the judge child, or the child with the eagle birthmark on his forehead. Very well done, I think. Very well delivered in Wagner's script, and of course Bolland executes perfectly.
Just a beautiful little page, and we also get, you know, a little bit of character development from Hershey as well, and she reacts to Lopez's death, and we get to see Dredd actually starting to have his own doubts about the mission and about what's happening with the judge child, and he's maybe touched by a streak of evil. So it's a very monumental, important moment in within the strip.
Yes, Hershey confronts Dredd, and I know that they've revisited that fairly recently in the last year or so, when she talked to Dredd about her first encounters with him on the Judge Child quest. And we see, you know, perhaps some of the characteristics of Hershey that will lead her and Dredd to have this ongoing, slightly antagonistic relationship as she develops as a judge and go on to become chief judge herself. And it all started here on the Judge Child quest.
One thing I love about Hershey, well, okay, confession time. I absolutely love Hershey. I think she is my absolute favorite Judge Dredd supporting character and secondary character in general.
Ah, this is what you trailed earlier.
Yeah. You know, anyone who's talked with me for more than an hour about Judge Dredd eventually, sooner or later, finds this one out. So what I like about Hershey in this episode, in this whole story actually, is that they are constantly setting her up as Dredd's equal. You know, her first appearance in Ghost of Echo 4, Dredd, they're both captured by robots. Dredd shoots Hershey's robot, and Hershey immediately shoots Dredd's robot. And then later on in the war episodes, Dredd loses the flag, Hershey picks it up, Hershey gets shot at, sends the flag to Dredd. They're explicitly saying these two are equals. They can do exactly the same stuff, and they can do the same things for each other, to each other. And when Hershey shows a moment of emotion for Lopez, a moment for, when she confronts Dredd about it, what's great is that Dredd says, this is understandable, her first experience of the death of a comrade. She's a good judge. She'll learn. So once again, they're trying to dodge this idea of, you know, you read comics from the 70s or early 80s, and women are usually portrayed as very emotional, as a foil to the stoicism of most male characters. But Dredd is explicitly saying this is not, it's not like Hershey cried because she's a woman. She cried because this is her first experience of the death of a comrade. Dredd doesn't see Hershey as a woman. She sees her as a judge, first and foremost. Everything else comes later. And it's interesting how it manages to get these small tidbits of establishing character in these kind of subtle, small ways. And it's also more interesting, one of the things I've been working on for over almost half a year now, I'm working on a retrospective of all the female judges appearing in 2000 AD, how they fit in into their continuity, or how they fit in into the development of the characters as well. And compared to Anderson, for instance, who is a very foily character to Dredd, she's much more jokey, she's much more jovial, she's more feminine in general. Hershey is established from day one to be the female Dredd, the equivalent to him within female judges. And this was actually, from what I've read on interviews with Wagner and Bolland, this was a very conscious effort. They wanted to make a woman who looked strict, who looked stern and who was every bit the judge that Red is. So it's interesting to see how they establish that right from the get-go. And at the same time, they establish that and they make sure not to bring attention to the fact that she's a woman. If she cries, it's because she's a rookie, not because she's overly emotional or whatnot.
It's terrific, yes. I mean, as you say, she's well established as Dredd's equal. She performs, you know, in action just as good as Dredd. As you said, I do like it when the other judges appear to be competent. I always find I have difficulties with stories where only Dredd can do something which the other judges can't. You know, we have to remember that they've all had the same training. They've all had those years in the academy since they were a child. And Hershey is a terrific character and, of course, would go on to be and, you know, still is a major character in Dredd's world.
So anyway, going back to the story, I got, you know, I just really like her. Going back to the story, we got another interlude, small two-episode interlude with a salesman, Rhinus, yes. Limpopop Quince.
Splendid.
Who, again, I feel like there's stuff in this story that was put in to have some fun. So Wagner has fun writing Limpopop's dialogue, and Ron Smith has fun just drawing him in general, like doing all these emotions and these expressions and just designing the guy in general. Such a great bit of, we're going to have some fun here. Let's just enjoy ourselves.
Yes, it's a crazy couple of episodes. It's like a little Twilight Zone has popped up in midway through the quest or towards the end of the quest. And we get this weird bit about the judges being miniaturized and kept in his display case. Ron Smith's character designs, just wonderful.
Also, you know how I mentioned that Ron Smith likes to draw dramatic poses and dramatic expressions?
Yep.
Okay, the first page of part 20, which sadly was taken away from some of the color reprints by Quality and Eagle, where the robots are questioning Rhinus about the disappearance of the judges. One of the robots is holding his arm up high in a fist, in a clenched fist, and the other is bow-legged pointing at Rhinus with one hand while his other is just floating to the side. And then, like, even the robots are getting in on the drama. Look at this guy. You're a robot. You're not supposed to get so emotional.
Yes, that's right. You can't draw a robot just being static and calm. They are dramatic and posed and full of action.
It's just great. And then we get the little bit where Dredd and company escape the display case and come out blasting. And again, we get Ron Smith drawing everyone holding two guns and shooting like cowboys. And then we get the release of all the creatures from inside the case. It's actually surprisingly not as dense as previous Ron Smith panels. Like, it doesn't fill it up with weirdo creatures, but the ones that are there are very effective.
Yes, the Orbal Carnivore and the Nanja Dragon, amazing stuff. So we have to move on towards the end of the quest when Dredd is going to finally catch up with the Angel Gang on the planet known as Xanadu, where they have taken, after they've terrorized a small town, they move on to the protection of the robot Free State and their robot leader, the Grunwalder.
Yeah. Here's actually where I have my biggest issue with this story, my big problem. We've had 20 parts of, well, 4 or 5 parts of crazy Earth action. We had 15 parts of crazy alien action. And what is the great planet for the end? Well, it's a Western world.
We're back in a Western small town, aren't we?
And, you know, okay, fine. Wagner wanted to write more rednecks, I guess. He wanted to write more of a Western thing. But it feels like a retreat. It feels like we're going back and we're not doing any more crazy stuff. And it's annoying because right after that, right after the Western bits, we get to the Grunwalder's kingdom, which is a great idea because it's, you know, here's a kingdom of robots. It's ruled entirely by robots. Some of them implant human hair on their bodies as their way of taking scalps. And I'm like, I want to know more about these guys.
Yes, but they only get two panels.
Yeah, and the previous episodes have this subplot about the old blind prospector who has been tortured by the Angel Gang, and he's desire for revenge. And that comes off as super awkward. It's like, suddenly we have to deal with this as well, and we had to do all this Western stuff. We have to have this revenge quest. And it feels very jarring compared to everything that has been building up to this point. And then to go back to the Grunwalder and to have his episodes be so underdeveloped compared to the rest feels annoying and feels a bit awkward.
But, I mean, as you say, it's back in small-town westerns and Dredd is sort of delivering the action, but also we get to see the horrors of the Angel Gang. We famously get Link Angel putting a coat hanger in a guy's mouth and hanging him up, which was thought to be, I know from Thrill Power Overload, they got complaints about that because they thought the children, some people thought the children might try to reproduce that activity.
Well, first of all I'm going to say is, if any child tries to do that, good luck. Like, how big your mouth or how small the coat hanger?
Absolutely. Or how nasty the Link Angel. And of course we get Mean Machine going up to four, having threatened it at several times throughout the previous episodes. And Dredd has to deal with him in a splendid Mick McMahon sequence.
Yeah, getting his arm shot as well.
This is where Mean Machine loses that left arm.
And we get the first time that the Mean Machine's dial gets stuck on 412 and he enters the mad, crazy budding madness.
Yes, that's right. The Mean Machine is stuck on 4.5 and he's on a butting frenzy, and then there's an enormous explosion and it seems like the end of Mean Machine Angel.
I'm still surprised there was enough of him to bury him.
Yes, because of course, you know, the Angel Gang were one of the breakout characters or group of characters from this quest. And they don't really make it. We're getting into spoiler territory now, but I think people know they don't make it to the end. But they will return in future epics because they were so popular that Wagner had to find a way to bring them back. As ever, John Wagner not showing any hesitation in killing off his supporting cast.
Yeah, and eventually he regretted that decision. He said, I shouldn't have killed them. They were too good, because he loves writing rednecks. I'm actually curious to find, I would like to find out maybe in an interview or something, how he chose specifically Mean Machine to be the one to be resurrected.
Do you think it was based on letters that they were getting about the popularity of the characters? Do you think it was a response to the readers?
Maybe a half and half. Like, on one side, I imagine, yes, they were hugely popular characters. On the other, I imagine Wagner had so much fun writing them. So, and I think Mean Machine might have been the one with the best gimmick, because Pa has very little use unless he has his sons around. Junior's gimmick is that he is trying to prove himself as the craziest guy ever. And Link has a hat and nothing else. But Mean Machine is the one with the best visual gimmick of half-robot psychopath who goes around headbutting people, has a claw. He looks much more striking than the rest, who look like two cowboys and a punk.
He, as you say, he's the most visually arresting of the characters. He's got the most going on. So it's perhaps no surprise that he was the popular one. And he was the one that was brought back, although, you know, perhaps Wagner's interest was in Junior Angel, because he's the one who makes it to the final sort of showdown with Dredd.
Right, and we have this beautifully Western.
I want to talk about a couple of Dredd character moments in this final part, because one is when he enters the robot free state, where no humans are allowed, and he makes his declaration to the Grunwalder about he will brook no interference, you have been formally warned. And the robot speaking to the Grunwalder says, you know, he's almost like a robot himself. And he says, yeah, there's steel beneath that flesh. A wonderful moment about Dredd's character at this stage in his development with Wagner. But then, of course, we've got to get on to after the showdown with Junior Angel and Par Angel, we get to, you know, obviously it's the biggest spoiler from the Judge Child Quest, but we get to Dredd's decision. And I know this was something that you particularly wanted to talk about that struck you from this story.
Yeah, absolutely. And it ties back to what you mentioned earlier. You know, Dredd is seen as a robot. There's still been his voice, everything. He looks like a robot. He speaks like one. But this is the biggest moment so far in the history of classic Dredd, where he's shown to have a personal, very personal sense of judgment above his orders, above his mission, beyond all that he has been told to do and think. Dredd can think for himself. So he looks into Owen Chrysler's eyes to see if he's evil. And as soon as he made his judgment, as soon as he decides if he's evil or not, immediately is, okay, no, I'm not going to bring you back. Bye, kid. And that is some huge moment for him as a character to me. That is the moment when the character started clicking. Because so far he has mostly been a robot, an enforcer. The most he has done would be, you know, bits in The Cursed Earth where he talks about protecting other people even if they're in The Cursed Earth. But it's always been portrayed as either a good guy thing to do or a part of the law itself. So he's still, so far he has always been tied to those kind of either the ideals of good guys or the regulations of the law. Here's where we see him thinking for himself, using his own capacity for judgment, his own individual sense of right and wrong. And he uses in such a short, strong manner. It's not like, you know, he spends a whole page talking with him or something. He just looks at the guy's eyes, at the kid's eyes, and he says, no, you're evil. Goodbye.
Yes, it's done, as you say, in just a couple of panels where he looks into the Judge Child's eyes. As you say, I see only evil. That's it. I'm on my way. And then the final sort of panel when they depart in Justice One, whatever danger is to come, we must face it on our own. If we perish, so be it. Let's go home. A real defining moment for Dredd, as you say, when he really sort of like, yeah, he makes his own decisions. He can judge right and wrong, and he'll stake it all, you know, the future of Mega City 1 on his judgment call. It is a striking moment at the end of this epic.
Yeah, and the best thing is that you can draw a perfect line from that to modern Dredd. Because here we have Dredd making a decision based on his own sense of judgment beyond what he's been taught and what he's been ordered, and being supremely confident about his decision. He doesn't brood on it. He doesn't, you know, sit around thinking, oh, did I do the right thing? He made a decision and he's going to stick by it. And even if that leads to disaster, they're going to fight it out on their own and he's going to be there. And you see nowadays in modern Dredd, the same deal, where he sees something that escapes what he has been taught, that goes beyond what he's been learned, that he uses his own personal judgment on, and he follows that decision to the end. You can see it in Mutants in Mega City 1, in Tour of Duty. You can see it in pretty much every major storyline that Wagner has written. You can see it in The Pit when he gets called, you know, oh, this one guy is too unstable, you need to let him go, and he keeps him on the job. You can see how he has a mind of his own, and he values other people having minds of their own. He values people who can have their own sense of judgment beyond the law. And the seeds to all that are planted here. And that's the moment where the character started turning for me, and where I went from being an enforcer and a super cop to a well-rounded three-dimensional human being who drives his own stories and who has agency within his own stories, which is something that is sorely lacking from action comics in general.
Fascinating. I'm intrigued that you've linked it so well to modern Dread. Because you're right, I was thinking of some of his decisions in Mutants in Mega City 1, but also at the end of Democracy Now, where he just goes out to meet the protesters by himself. We could also, I suppose, talk about the ending of the Apocalypse War, which will be coming up on a future episode. So, yeah, a remarkable defining moment for Dread. And we get this wonderful coda in this last episode written by Wagner and Grant, where he's back on Mega City 1. The Council of Five are sitting in judgment on the call he made about Owen Chrysler. But meanwhile, Dredd is just back out on the streets with Judge Giant, and it's another day on the streets. He shows little interest in the deliberations of the Council of Five. He just, whatever decision they'll make, fair enough. Right now, there's work to do.
And it's also great that here we have another establishing moment for modern Dread in general, which is Dread being at odds with the Council and the Council not being portrayed as villains. I mean, this isn't the Judge Cal situation. This is a group of people, of Dread's bosses, having a valid complaint about the way he went about doing things and the decision he made. And you can see them deliberating and asking, well, was he right? Was he wrong? So we have this idea that Dredd is he's not the most beloved judge for his bosses. For the judge on the street, yes, he's a hero and everything. For the chief judge, Griffin himself, for people who know him, he's a hero. For people who only see him by his actions, and by his actions in particular cases, he is kind of... maybe not a loose cannon, but he's a bit too individualistic for their taste. And so we get, for example, McGruder's first appearance as being kind of an antagonistic force towards Dredd, that he needs to stay in line and follow his orders. And he needs to be... It's kind of funny because she says that Dredd is too stubborn for his own good, that he won't bend in the wind. And unless that he does that, he'll break. But what they're arguing is that Dredd should have stuck to his orders. So they're complaining about him being too stubborn, but in the wrong way. That instead of sticking to his orders, he was too stubborn about his own judgment. And it sets up this conflict between what the Council wants Dredd to do and what Dredd does. That again, you can see going all the way back to literally just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it's terrific. We get these lovely little bits of the Council of Five. And as you say, this is a changing age. We must change with it. A reed that won't bend in the wind will always break. But Chief Judge Griffin sort of overrules them in Dredd's favour. It's a lovely ending, I think, to what's been a terrific Dredd epic, one of the defining epics of the early years. Absolute astounding stuff throughout.
Also, I love when one character is, questioning Dredd and another character retorts, well, you saw what he did, right? Like, you've seen him in action. You know what he did. He's not going to be a bad guy, or he didn't do that as part of some evil, whatever. Yeah. It's like when some other character tries to say that he's too old or that his judgment is impaired, and someone goes, well, what did you do in insert epic here?
Remember how Dredd stood for the city in the past. Yeah. Okay, splendid. It's, as I've said, it's a marvellous epic. Delight that you've picked it. We've already talked, I think, about your favourite episodes being, I think, the War Games on the alien planet.
War Games and everything with Murd the Necromancer.
splendid.
Oh, I love that guy.
And your favourite supporting character, Judge Hershey. If, you know, when we did The Cursed Earth, we talked about Bolland and McMahon, and I made Jim Moon sort of pick between the artists. Here you've got three artists to pick from, Bolland, McMahon and Smith. Would you be able to pick out a favourite from the whole epic?
No.
Too hard to call.
But because, again, each one's episode is so unique and so flawless that I just can't imagine it being drawn by anyone else. I can't imagine McMahon doing the War Planet one. Like, you know how McMahon, when he drew, for example, the first few chapters of Blockmania, he complained about having to draw all these tiny people. Imagine him trying to draw all these tiny people killing each other in the middle of a giant planet with a giant war wheel running them over. He would have gone mental. So everyone is too good of a fit for what they're each one doing. So I wouldn't be able to say I have a favorite one, because every time I try to think about it, I immediately go, oh, well, but, you know, oh, I love, McMahon is the best. He did all the creepy horror fantasy stuff, and he did Texas City, which is gorgeous. Oh, but Ron Smith did all these crazy god action scenes and these weird aliens. Oh, but Bolland did all this wonderful expression work and all these wonderful scenes. If you put a gun to my head and you said, you know, make a choice, I'd say McMahon by a very small margin, like tiny, infinitesimal. With Smith right next to him, and Bolland at the end, only because he only drew such a small part of it. Like, it's a huge, but it's a huge part in terms of paneling and effect. But pound by pound, it's Smith or McMahon.
Okay, I've sort of forced you to it. Let's play the fantasy artwork game then instead. If you had an unlimited budget granted to you by Mega City Book Club and all this artwork was available, would you have a page or a cover or a double page splash that you would like to own, if that was possible?
Yes, I have either the first double page of Justice One by Bolland.
Okay, Bolland's Justice One, yep.
For two reasons. One, it's Bolland. And two, that is the first appearance in panel of Judge Hershey, and I...
Your favorite supporting character.
Yeah, I do horrible, unspeakable stuff for that. Then the page, some of the action scenes in the War and War Planet ones, anything with Ren and Hershey on a Lawmaster, I want it. And as far as covers go, I'd love the anything to report Lopez cover with the stretch faces and all, because again, first time that Hershey was on a cover.
Yes, okay. So, very, very interesting. We'll grant you all of those in the fantasy art display for Mega City Book Club. For me, I'm going to pick, if you turn to the Judge Child Part 25, Hell's Angel. It's a double-page splash by Ron Smith of Mount Fire is erupting again, Grunwalder. And we get a sort of silhouette almost, or chiaroscuro dread. We get this fantastic volcano eruption and the Grunwalder looking upon it out the window. So that double page splash, That's my fantasy grail page.
It's so good.
It is so good. I mean, if you have the volume to hand, turn to part 25 and feast your eyes on that, but also go back to the first appearance of Justice One and Hershey and Lopez done by Brian Bolland.
I love how Ron Smith draws the Grunwalder like a buff C-3PO.
Yes. C-3PO on steroids. Tremendous. Okay, it's been absolutely terrific. Obviously, the Judge Child Quest has been reprinted many, many times in a variety of formats. Probably one of the most reprinted of Judge Dredd's epics, up there with the original Judge Death stories. I've been looking at a Titan reprint from 2004, which has all the episodes in black and white. Probably the easiest way to get hold of it now, I should imagine, is in the Complete Case Files Volume 4, which obviously you can get in hard copy and digital from the 2000 AD online store. But also, I think it will be out as one of the volumes of the Hachette Mega Collection. I believe it's going to be towards the end of the 80 issues, sometime next year in 2017, I think.
Also, it also got reprinted in one of those small pocket manga editions.
Oh, that's right. I did remember picking that up, and I did it as one of my charity auctions because I got it signed by Ron Smith and John Wagner. Yes, I do remember that, a little pocket digest-sized version.
Yeah, I love those things because even though it's not the best possible option, because I always say that if you're reading 2000 AD, you want to get it on the biggest, largest size possible. But those ones are great because you can give them to people. Like, hey, you want to read Red? This. Here, have this.
This is what you want. Yeah.
Start here.
Splendid stuff. So highly recommended Judge Child Quest. And I've mentioned them briefly. If you're interested in my charity auctions for cancer research, by the time this podcast comes out, I'll probably have been to Thought Bubble and there will be some more stuff up on eBay. So look for links on the forum, the 2080 forums. And this is the part of the podcast where I talk to my guests about their own projects. So a couple of things are on. Firstly, you mentioned your history of female judges in Dread Stories. Where can we find that on the internet?
You can find it on my Tumblr blog, which is judgeanon.tumblr.com, all just in one word. From there, either look for the tags in Judge Dread or put in the number, usually it's under My Writing or 2080. It has been reblogged by the 2080 Twitter and their Facebook, and they actually, oh my god, I can't believe they put it on the regular Thrill Mail.
Oh, lovely.
I saw that and I just, oh my god. Well, now I need to go back and rewrite it because, but that was massively cool of them. I just can't thank them enough. And right now I'm going to start, I have the next week off work. So I'm going to start working on part, I think it's part 5, which is the end of the Miller-Morrison era. Miller Ennis Morrison era.
Right.
And finally, something that people have been asking since the first part, which is the debut of Judge DeMarco.
Ah, Galen DeMarco, yes. Splendid. So judgeanon.tumblr.com. That link will be in the show notes for this episode. And awesome. Tell us about your forthcoming work with or in Zarjazz.
I've been sending stuff to Zarjazz. Dave has been a terrific editor. And the next one, the one that's coming out in the November edition, is actually the very first script that I sent him. And that was like 3-4 years ago. Back then it got an artist, but the artist had to drop out for personal reasons. He had other jobs lined up. So I basically gave up on it. I was like, ah, well, it doesn't matter. It's just one. By this point, I'd already sent like 3 other scripts. And I said, ah, well, it doesn't matter. And like 2 months ago, I get an email from Dave. He says, here are all the pages. What? Here are all the drawn pages. Yeah, we got another artist to go in. And it's by, let me double check the name. Oh, I feel terrible about having to double check this. Yeah, Daniel Dwyer.
Right. Yes, okay. So an actual droid.
So he drew the script and Dave sends me the pages and I go, oh, awesome, great. And he says, well, you know, I sent you this so you can check for typos, or check for any errors or anything you want to change. I want to change like 75% of the last 2 pages because I wrote them like 4 years ago and I'm looking at them now and they're absolutely awful. And it's going, if this comes out, it's going to kill me. I can't let it go out like this. So Dave very graciously accepted all of my changes and now it's coming out real soon and I'm real excited about it. But other than that, I also worked on
that was, the first one was Fear and Loathing, which was an SGS strip for Sargeus 21.
Right.
Got very good reviews at the time, kind of a bit of a proud moment. Then A Day in the Life, which is a strip I made for Sargeus 26, which is a dream come true for me because it stars Judge Hershey.
Splendid.
Which was a day in the life of her as a chief judge. And the next one is called Law in Exile. I'm not going to say anything because, you know, spoilers, and it's coming out in a few months. But look forward to it. Look forward to the gorgeous art by Dwyer. And, well, it's going to be a good one. And on top of that, well, 2 weeks ago, I sent an actual script for Fury Shock to 2080. Hopefully it will go through. I already sent one 2 years ago and they declined it, but gave me some little feedback on it. So this is my second shot at it. It's called Infinite Semiosis, and it's an attempt at mixing science fiction with semiotics. So it's going to be kind of a trip. Hopefully it gets through. I'd love to see it happen, and I'd love to see it in the pages.
So fingers crossed for that. Yes, absolutely. And we look out for your story in the next issue of Sargeus, which again may be out when I see Dave at Thought Bubble. And if you're not familiar with Sargeus and Dog Breath, check out the Quayquam blog on the quayquamblog.blogspot.com, or just Google Sargeus fanzine and that will take you to it, and you can find all the issues there. Wonderful stuff. Great. Well, Santi, thank you very much. That's been wonderful. Great fun talking about the Judge Child Quest, and fascinating to hear about your other work. I must go and read the female judges stuff on Tumblr.
If you'd like, I can give you a link so you can link it on the page or whatever.
Yeah, send me the link and I'll put that in the show notes.
Sure thing.
So thank you very much for listening to Mega City Book Club. Do get in touch with me to talk about any 2000 AD book. You'll find the list of all the episodes so far and the books chosen for upcoming episodes on the Facebook page. So please pop across there, like the page and check the book lists. And you'll also find a list of the books that I would like to cover myself if you need some help making a selection. You can find all my links at megacitybookclub.com. And if you want to get in touch, email me at mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to 2000 AD and Rebellion Publishing for putting out these splendid books. I should probably add that this is a completely unofficial fan cast, but you probably knew that already. They own all the copyright material. We just own our enthusiasm and our opinions. And so until next time on Mega City Book Club, when we'll be passing judgment on another 2000 AD book, it's time for goodbyes. So it's goodbye from me and...
Buenas tardes a todos.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Goodbye. Why?